I'd like to begin the sermon this afternoon with a patriarch, an individual in the Old Testament that is very well known. And I'm talking about the patriarch Joseph. Well, we will go there, and I'd just like to read the story. Well, we're breaking into the middle of the story to a certain extent. It's after that Joseph had encountered unique dreams, and then he is sent on a mission by his father. We'll pick up the story in Genesis chapter 37, if you'll go there, please. Genesis chapter 37. And we read here that Israel said to Joseph in verse 13, are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said to him, here I am. And he said to him, please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me. So he sent him in out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, there he was, wandering in the field, and a man asked him, saying, what are you seeking? And he said, I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks. And the man said, they have departed from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. I mean, this is a real example of patriarchal brotherly love. Then they said to one another, look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of his hands and bring him back to his father. So at least one of the brothers had some benevolence toward Joseph. So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. And now this I find astonishing. So after you've done all of this, you sit down and you eat. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm and myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. I lost my place here, sorry. Verse 29, then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes, and he returned to his brothers and said, the lad is no more, and I, where shall I go? So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, we have found this. Do you know whether this is your son's tunic or not? So the interesting thing here is their approach to things. They did not tell their father what they did. They asked a question. And this is very common with deception. It's very common with deception because it prevented them ostensibly from having to lie. I mean, they could have said, look, we found this. It's clear that Joseph has been killed. We're very sorry. But then they would have been lying. So what they did instead is they simply asked a question so that their father could draw his own conclusion. You know, how nice, how thoughtful of them to do that. And he recognized it and said, it is my son's tunic. Unfortunately, there was no DNA testing back then, because if it had been, they would have easily been able to take a test from the blood and recognize that this was a complete fraud. But Israel correctly concluded that it was Joseph's tunic. Then Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his waist and mourned for his sons many days, and all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted, and he said, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept, and the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an official of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. So now we've read the story, a story that obviously we are all very familiar with. Joseph was the favorite son of Israel, and he went down to Egypt and was sold there to Potiphar at the behest of his conniving brothers. I'd like you to set that aside just for a moment. That sets the context of the patriarch that we're going to explore this afternoon, and I'd like to set the context and the framework for the message. I want to quote from a very famous quote from Theodore Roosevelt that I think has bearing or has application in the case of Joseph. You've all heard this. It is not the critic who counts. Not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles. I mean, these are strong and powerful words that remain as true today as they were back when Theodore Roosevelt famously gave the speech in France. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who actually is in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. Whenever we do something, it is going to be imperfect. No matter how well it is planned, no matter how well it is executed, it is not going to be perfect. The only thing that is worse is to not do anything at all. And this is a common form of paralysis that intellectuals procrastinate is the word I wanted to use. They continue to plan and they plan and they plan, because as long as you're planning and you don't ever execute anything, it is very difficult to criticize it. You can intellectually always propose how to do it better. But in my experience, it is when you do something that you learn something on how to make things better and things actually can get done. Because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds? Who knows great enthusiasms, great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls that know neither victory or defeat. Though that closing statement of this particular paragraph, and by the way, this is an excerpt from a speech that went a long, long time. This is one of the excerpts that has become very famous. So from this, I draw the message that I want to share with you this afternoon. And it is entitled this, "The Doer's Creed." Out of this particular passage, Theodore Roosevelt created what I have dubbed today the Doer's Creed, and it goes like this, that you do all you can with what you have, where you are at. And I think the story of Joseph exemplifies putting that credo into action. And the interesting thing is that this doer's credo or creed is actually the critic's curse. The doer's credo is the critic's curse, because those who intellectually critique often have accomplished very little themselves, and because they have no experience in the actual doing, make prognostications and projections that often are very wrong. As we go back to Joseph's story, we will see that. So I've divided this into three parts: doing all you can. You know, it is so human to conclude and to say, well, you know, I just can't do anything. So most people try to do what they can't with resources that are not at their disposal in a situation that they're entirely unqualified for. And that is a recipe for disaster. But it never gets to the point of actually doing something. It's just that you bemoan the fact that you can't do anything because you don't have the resources. Everybody in the United States of America has resources. And those of us in the Church of God have enormous resources, which I want to bring to bear today to show everybody, all of us, that are listening to us today or in the future, that you can have a takeaway and know that it is that there's something that you can do to make a difference with what you have because of who you are. So let's take a look, first of all, at doing all you can. Notice in Genesis chapter 39, in verse 4. So Joseph found favor in his sight, the Potiphar, and served him. And think about this. You have Joseph, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, who had been betrayed by his own brothers and sold as a slave. I mean, slavery was part of every culture in the history of man down to our time, when the United States finally and firstly, along with Britain, abolished slavery. The freedoms that we have today and the freedom from slavery that we enjoy in the United States is an historic anomaly. We read about slavery in the New Testament. Paul wrote to slaves. He gave instructions to both slave and master. But notice that Joseph, in his very difficult situation here, did not bemoan the fact that he had been betrayed by his brothers, that he had been sold out of his household, and had gone from a free and privileged man to become a slave. It simply says that he did what he could. He served Potiphar. That was in his power to do. He served him. Then Potiphar made him overseer, because Joseph did what he could in the situation that he was. God was able to bless him in his situation, and Potiphar made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put into his hand. You see, when we do things, it engenders trust, as it did here. So it was verse 5, from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Not only was Joseph successful, but because of God's blessing that was predicated on the fact that Joseph did something, he blessed the household of the Egyptian Potiphar. I mean, I find that to be absolutely amazing, but it is a truism. It requires our action in order for God to intervene. I've related this story before, but it bears repeating. Early on, when I came into the church, an elder told me that, well, he asked me a mathematical question, and he said, what is 1 times 0? I said, well, 0. I mean, even Amish math knew that. He asked me, what is 5 times 0? I said, still 0. So he said, okay, what is 5 times 2? I said, well, 10. And that was the result. That was the product, if you will, to use a mathematical term. So his point was that if we put forth 0 effort, even if God attempts to multiply our 0 effort by 5, it's still 0. But if we put forth an effort of 1, it turns into 5. If we double that to 2, the product becomes 10. If we take it to a 3, it becomes 15. If you push it to 4, all of a sudden it multiplies, shall we say, 20-fold. You see, Joseph in Potiphar's house could have sulked and not put forth any effort. And in that capacity, Joseph would have never known, as we read from Theodore Roosevelt's quote, the triumph of high achievement, which he later would. So here we have a great example of doing all you can. Now, let's drop down to later in the chapter, and I'm skipping over the... Oh, maybe I shouldn't skip over, so let me just paraphrase it. So Joseph was doing the right thing. He was serving Potiphar. And then he encountered multiple times Potiphar's wife who was trying to tempt him. And he did the right thing. And as the saying goes, no good deed goes unpunished. And then we find that here in... Verse 20, then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. And then in verse 21, we have the statement that's just amazing. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy. I mean, are you kidding me? I served my master. I did not sulk. I prospered in his house. I was falsely accused. He put me in prison. And then the text reads that the Lord was with Joseph. And he showed him mercy. You know, his mercy like that. Maybe, you know, you don't need any blessings. He showed him mercy. And he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all that the prisoners who were there in the prison, and whatever they did there, it was his doing. And I mean, the trust level was so high. I mean, here again, Joseph could have taken a very different attitude and position. But because he did what he could in the situation in which he found himself, God was able to show him mercy and give him a blessing. Verse 23, the keeper of the prison did not look at anything that was under Joseph's hand because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. May we come back to that equation that I had shared just a few minutes ago. It was Joseph's doing that enabled, and the type of doing that he was doing, that enabled God to give him his blessing and to show him mercy and to prosper him even as he was in prison. So that's the story. I'd like to just take us now to a couple of other scriptures that undergird that concept. Over in Ecclesiastes 9 in verse 10, a very familiar scripture. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 10. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. So do it. You know, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Give it everything you've got. And you will be amazed at what you can do with the little bit that you may think that you have. And, you know, to those that have more resources, and, you know, even myself, who maybe has more resources than most, it is still true that in order to be able to be effective, you have to do it with all your might. Whatever God has blessed you with, it is important to do that. I have here a little essay, Conquering the Enemy Called Average. I mean, that has become almost fashionable. Well, you know, don't overdo it. You know, just be average. You know, actually, American exceptionalism is criticized. It is seen, you know, as a bad thing. I mean, that's insane. I mean, we have been the recipients, as Abraham Lincoln said, of the choicest bounties of heaven. And, you know, we're reading about the patriarch Joseph, and we have had the blessings that we have enjoyed in this country because God was faithful to his promise to Abraham. And as Abraham's children, we have been the recipients of those blessings. And we are at a time now as a country in which we will have to choose whether or not we value those privileges that have been given to us and the blessings that come along with it, or whether we are going to choose tyranny, which the world has experienced down through time with this one exception. I mean, that is just a fact. So the United States, for all its faults, and believe me, there are many, has been an exceptional nation in the history of the world. Let's not, as individuals, move it down to average. Average is the enemy. Notice, this is written by John Mason. Don't know anything about the man, but I like the quote. Every person tends to underrate or overrate that which they do not possess. Now think about this, you know. The doer's credo is to do all you can with what you have. And John Mason says here that we tend to underrate or overrate that which we do not have. I mean, it's just human nature. Ed Howe, he writes, said, people are always neglecting something they can do and try to do something that they can't. You know, one of the benefits, I think, of getting a little bit older is at some point you just realize that, for example, I should not sing opera. I mean, I have the resources. I could go get voice lessons and opera singing lessons, but it would be an incredible waste of money because I could spend thousands on it. And one thing, I'm sure of one thing, you would not come to the concert. I mean, you just wouldn't come. And yet, you know, we tend to think about, wow, that would be nice. I admire people that have a voice that can sing like that, but we neglect when we are wasting our time thinking about and complaining about what we can't do. We are neglecting something that we can do, as he said here. So here is another quote from another excerpt from this same essay. Ken Keyes Jr. said, to be upset over what you don't have is to waste what you do have. To be upset about what you don't have is to waste what you do have. Think about that in the context of Joseph. He had his coat of many colors ripped from him to provide false evidence to his father and was sold as a slave. But he did what he could as a slave. He did what he could as a prisoner. And as the text states, the Lord was with him and gave him favor and prospered everything that he did. That is a remarkable promise that we do well to leverage today. And again, once we get into what we have, I think you will see there is a lot that we can do today. Don't wait till tomorrow, because tomorrow never comes. Don't shrink back. Do what you can. Notice, to be upset over what you don't have is to waste what you do have. The truth is that many are successful because they didn't have the advantage others had. People with enterprise accomplish more than others because they go ahead and do it before they are ready. I have here in my conference room a plaque on the wall. I just thought of this. An entrepreneurship award, and you know, I went there and they had some speakers, and there was a professor emeritus from the Ohio University, if my recollection is correct, that gave a speech that I found to be thought-provoking. He was speaking to a group of entrepreneurs and businessmen, and he started his talk with a question that a lot of people would ask. He said, I would like to know what is the biggest and most common cause of new startup failures. And of course, answers came back, and one of the most frequent answers was lack of capital, lack of resources. You know, you didn't have enough resources and enough capital to be able to go through that startup phase until the business became viable and profitable. And he countered and said the number one cause of business failure is the number one cause of new startup failures is too much capital. And then he cited the examples, and of course everybody there was kind of like taken aback that he would take a position like that. But I found his argument made sense. Now clearly there's always an exception to every rule, and there are certainly, I'm sure, a case can be made that ventures fail because they didn't have the proper or enough resources, and if they had been better funded, they would have achieved something. But his point was that a lot of very successful companies started in a garage. You know, you have everybody from Dell Computer to Microsoft to, you can make a longer list, the United States. One of the exceptional aspects of the United States has been that we've had a free market and an environment where people can actually get started in a garage, as I did, and make a go of it. And his point that stuck with me was this. When you are in a garage enterprise, let's say, or a startup with limited resources, you have to do everything you can with what you've got. And you do not have the resources and the money to hire expensive consultants and all of those kinds of things that, you know, he cited one example of a startup that had every element to be successful, including $90 million of seed money. And it took them exactly a year to be completely broke. They hired the best consultants. They hired all the experts. They spent money like there was no tomorrow. And in the end, there was no tomorrow because they lacked action. The other thing that this professor said that stuck with me is that when you are under pressure, and believe me, I know what that feels like, when you're under pressure to deliver, you either succeed or fail based on whether or not you are able to be innovative and creative enough to find a solution without experts and consultants. And when you do that, it bakes efficiencies into an organization. It becomes part of the organizational structure and fabric that provides long-term success. When we take this back to, you know, the New Testament church, and we take it to the story of Joseph, this is precisely what happens. Joseph did what he could with what he had in prison. And it was what he learned in prison that enabled him to have the humility to be the most powerful person in the country without it going to his head. Let's go to something that Paul said. Paul, over in Philippians chapter 4, you know, this is one of those scriptures that gets bantered about by Christians, and it's usually taken completely out of context. So I'm going to do what we normally do, and that is to take it out of context. And then we're going to look at the context. But if you've heard this once, you've heard it 1,000 times. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That's Philippians chapter 4, verse 13. The mistake we made, I mean, and I believe that. I have no argument with the fact that that is true. I just want to provide context. Notice what he says in the very first verse prior to that, verse 11. Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. And then he enumerates them. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Remember what Theodore Roosevelt said? You know, there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, great devotions, who spends himself on a worthy cause, who at worst fails. I mean, Paul said that he knew how to be abased, and he knew how to abound. I mean, that is part of our walk. That is part of life. There are hills and valleys. There are achievements, hopefully, and there are failures. The worst thing that you can ever be is to be numbered among those poor and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat because, you know why? They do nothing. Paul did things, and he knew how to be abased, and he knew how to be abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And nevertheless, you have done well that you shared in my distress. That is the context. And I would submit to you that anybody that has had a measure of success understands that dynamic. That success, particularly spiritual success or success in preaching the gospel or living the life that Jesus Christ prescribed for us, is only done, can only be accomplished in the context in which Paul wrote to the Philippians, with great affliction in many cases and a lot of challenge, but succeeding by doing all you can with what you've got. So what have we got? What do we all share? Let's go, we'll go back to the patriarch Joseph first, and then we'll bring it to the present, because, you know, physically or spiritually, everybody in the United States of America has resources. We just have to do something with them. Genesis chapter 41. Genesis chapter 41. And again, I know, and I read the story of Joseph to kind of set the stage, and I'm making, I think, a very good assumption, and that is that everybody that's hearing this knows the story of Joseph. So I will just take excerpts here. So now we've got Joseph in a different environment, and I think it's interesting in how he, when he is in front of Pharaoh in verse 15, and Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I have dreamed a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it, but I have heard it said of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it." So Joseph answered Pharaoh and said, "It is not in me." God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. So Joseph didn't claim to have the ability to interpret dreams. Even though he had done so, he attributed that ability rightly to God's revelation. But implicit in this statement is also the fact that that was an ability that he had. He just clarified to Pharaoh how he had that ability. Notice over in verse 25, he makes a similar statement. "Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, 'The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do.'" So I wanted to read that example because at the end of the day, everything that we have, every ability that we have, everything that we have got, in one way or another, is sourced from God. So while on the one hand, we should never forget that, on the other, it is important that we do something with it and that we recognize that we have that. So let's look at three things that we have that we can translate into action, and that should give us confidence to act so that we should not be numbered among those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. And if there's ever been a time in recent history in which we need a desire to not be numbered among the cold and timid souls that know neither victory nor defeat, it is right now in our current situation. Genesis chapter 1. Verse 26, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image according to our likeness.'" So here's something that we have that is unique to humanity. It also speaks and strikes at the heart of the fallacy of the current issue that we see bandied around with respect to race. There is only one race. The Bible says there is only one, man is of all of one blood. God created man in his image, and he gave that man variety of various different skin colors. but all are made into the image of God. And to differentiate is by definition racist. So notice here that God gave us an identity. Sonship made in the image of God, but he did so for a specific reason that resonates with the doer's credo. He said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, and over all the earth and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So we are created in the image of God, not evolved from the ape. I mean, think about the difference. We are created in the image of God specifically to do things, as enumerated in this particular passage, to have dominion over the fish of the sea. You know, if you follow the backstory, you know, we most recently evolved from apes who, you know, if you go back far enough, we supposedly climbed out of the sea, okay, and then walked upright. I mean, it is complete foolishness to suggest that something like that could have any basis in science. And the more that science goes down the route away from the founding argument of the founding of our country, that we are endowed by our Creator, referring to this passage, no doubt, by unalienable rights, the deeper we go into the foolishness that we see all over being touted as science today. And we see one of them in the very next verse. So God created man in his image. Now what does this look like? In the image of God, he created them, Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Male and female, he created them. We need to unapologetically take that position. You know, we have, if I may just digress here for a moment, the narrative that is out there currently, I'm going to wait for a little bit, but I want you to think about the narrative that we're seeing in the public space, in the public sphere of ideas that are being legitimized, and unfortunately, and this is very unfortunate, and this is part of the problems. People who consider themselves Christian embrace some of these ideas. And that is something that we individually must challenge ourselves, because if we don't, Christ will. Okay, just a couple of other scriptures here. This idea of being created in the image of God is repeated in Genesis chapter 5, in verse 1, where the origins of man are enumerated. This is the origin of man. This Genesis, by the way, just while I think of it, Genesis, the question comes up, is Genesis history? Let me tell you. If you come with me just a few pages forward, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, after the creation of the Sabbath day that we celebrate today, we read this in verse 4. This is the history of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day the Lord made the heavens and the earth, before any plant of the field was on the earth. So Genesis, with its own testimony, testifies to be history. So when you hear these ideas, about Genesis being poetic or a metaphor or something else, just dispense with it. It's not true. Genesis chapter 5 says, this is the book of the genealogy of Adam. in the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female, and blessed them and called them mankind in the day that they were created. One of the organizations that has gotten prominence over the past 4 years is called Black Lives Matter. Have you ever been to their website? Have you ever checked out what they stand for? They unapologetically have on their website what they believe. So, let me just give you a couple of examples. I'll let you go there and read it for yourself. Which one do I start with here? So this is, remember what I just read. I've read twice by the testimony of the Word of God that God created man male and female and then formed the first family. This is one of their statements of belief. We disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure requirement by supporting each other as extended families and quote-unquote villages that collectively care for one another, especially our children, to the degree the mothers, parents, and children are comfortable. One of their stated purposes is to disrupt the nuclear family. Here is another one. We foster a queer-affirming network. We gather. When we gather, we do so with the intention of freeing ourselves from the tight grip of heteronormative thinking, or rather the belief that all the world are heterosexual. That's just two statements from their statements of beliefs. That is diametrically the opposite of what the words of Scripture say. So if you consider yourself a Christian, you need and you have gotten caught up with the quote-unquote popular slogan, Black Lives Matter, you need to challenge what you're getting yourself involved in, or Christ will. Black Lives Matter is up to no good. They are a Marxist organization that whose stated purpose is to disrupt everything that we stand for. Make no mistake about it. So the first thing that we have that enables us to do is embedded right in the creation story, the image of God that gives us the privilege to have dominion over the creation that he has given us. And then there's the second thing. We have the truth. We have the truth. And the truth gives us the ability to act. John chapter 8, verse 32 says, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free, and I'm going to act to do." You know, when you know the truth, it says here, the promise is that it will make you free. I mean, I think a lot of people think about this in the context of the truth setting us free. But it says that it actually makes us. It shapes us and makes us free and gives us the ability to do. So this is something that we've got, that we have to stick to with everything that we have. Because this is a statement that, I mean, what we imagine and what we can conjure up in our minds and the fears that we have once we know the truth, And when we know the truth is never as scary as the imaginations of the human heart. Truth sets free because it does a similar thing to love. Love casts out fear, and fear manipulates, and that is why fear mongers use the power of fear to get you and I to do things, because that is a mechanism of control. God gives us truth so that we can be made free. I mean, the line and in the sand here is huge. God is a liberator. Satan enslaves. God provides truth and love which drives out fear. Satan spreads fear. Satan spreads fear. 1 Thessalonians has a pointed statement as it concludes in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. First Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 21 says, "Prove or test all things. Hold fast what is good." That has never, ever been more important. I mean, there is so much misinformation being circulated today about the situation that we are in, and it is with the express purpose of making us afraid, because that provides control mechanisms. You need to test all things and hold fast to what is good, and what's true is good. Matthew chapter 24, I'll just paraphrase it, says that the time will be so deceitful that if it were possible, it would deceive even the elect. And that is something that we must be mindful of in the time that we live in. The third thing that we have that enables us to do is found over in 2 Timothy chapter 1. Again, these are very familiar scriptures. But we need to not only remember them and memorize them, but more importantly, claim them and act on them. Here we have Timothy receiving a letter from the Apostle Paul, who said, "Therefore I remind you to stir up the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." That is really important right now. We have no reason to be fearful. We also should not be foolish. But what we are seeing today is at best the beginning of sorrows. The virus that, the best numbers that I have seen recently is, it is a virus that has a 99.7% survival rate. And, you know, if there's one thing that I'm sure about is that the numbers that are out there are not accurate. It's just a question of how inaccurate they are. But even by our own experience in this community, it is a virus that needs to be respected and, you know, not to be foolish about, but it is not something that we should fear. Because for most people, it is similar to a normal flu. So think about it. Think about what we have done as a country to combat something that has a 99.7% survival rate. The economic damage, and here's kind of my three-point summary of my perspective right now. It could change. I'm not afraid of the virus. I'm concerned about it. It should not be dealt with foolishly. I am very concerned, or I'm very concerned about the economic damage that will be forthcoming. I'm well connected in economic circles and spoke with an individual just yesterday that's in the hospitality business. And if we think that life is going to return to normal in a couple of months, we are gravely wrong. Hospitality restaurants is a difficult business in the best of times, and the mandates that we have today to have restaurants operate at a 50% capacity, whatever the intention, you know, maybe that makes sense to a health expert. It does not make business sense, and the reality is those restaurants are not going to be there much longer because they cannot operate. So then the question is, okay, that's fine, so we don't have restaurants. So how do you feed the people? Well, you feed them at home. Okay, so now you have supply chains that get disrupted and food has to get reallocated. There's a whole mess of problems that is what you call unintentional consequences that have not even begun to hit us yet. And that's just one example. So I'm very concerned, as we all should be, on what the outcome and the consequences of that is going to be. Number three, I am absolutely terrified at the very real prospect of us dismantling the foundations and the fabric and the structure of the most prosperous and freest country in the history of man. And it does not take much imagination to see how that can happen. If you go to Minnesota and Minneapolis, here's what is not commonly known. In a space of a week or so, in response to one incident with a policeman, they burned down over 1,500 buildings. It looks like bombed out Beirut. I mean, that's the reality. That is going to take a long time to rebuild, and the irony is that the people who are least able to deal with a situation like that are going to be disproportionately negatively affected. I mean, that is why it is extremely important that we stick to the truth, lest we be deceived, and that has a whole spectrum of consequences, a whole spectrum of implications. And, you know, I will be the first to admit that I understand the truth imperfectly, but there's one thing that I will tell you. I am passionate about finding the truth because it is truth that sets us free. Not some projection, not somebody's idea or opinion, or my opinion for that matter. My opinion doesn't matter. It isn't worth squat. What matters is what is actually true, because that's what's going to play out. You cannot print enough money to make the consequences of, like, just to use the example of hospitality operating at 50%, to take away the consequences of that. They'll simply close. It has destroyed the livelihoods of millions upon millions of people. Was it worth it? We'll see. We will understand it better in some time. I doubt it. I think way more people will be killed, die, and be affected than the lives we purportedly saved. But, you know, all lives matter. That's not a question. So it's very important that we look at facts that are measurable, and especially when it comes to spiritual matters, and stick to it. You know, we have a truth that we celebrate today, and that's the Sabbath day. That's something that we need to stick to with all our hearts and minds, and celebrate the Sabbath and worship as we are commanded. So one more scripture over in John chapter 16 with respect to the power of the universe. John chapter 16, in verse 13, here we have Jesus Christ speaking about this power of the universe that was to come. And it says, "However, when he, the Spirit of truth, has come, he will guide you into all truth, for he will not speak on his own authority, but whatever he hears he will speak, and he will tell you things to come. He will glorify me, for he will take of what is mine and declare it to you." So, truth glorifies God and recognizes him as the Creator. This is why, you know, you go to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1 explains so much about the situation that we're in. It also explains why very smart people come to very foolish conclusions and make foolish recommendations that are catastrophically wrong. Because they no longer retain God in their knowledge, and God provides wisdom through the Spirit of truth that he provides to those who believe. So here we are. We need to do all we can with what we've got. Think about what we've got. We bear the very image of the Creator of the universe. We have been given the truth of his word. We have and we profess, and hopefully it's more than a profession, we profess to follow the embodiment of truth, because Jesus didn't say, "I came to bring you the truth." He said, "I am truth." And then finally, we have the very power of God at our disposal. So don't tell me you can't do anything. We can do all things through Jesus Christ who strengthens us, if we have the courage to deal with the abasement and the controversy that will inevitably come with that kind of doing. So that brings us to the ultimate. Where are you at? Go back to Joseph in Genesis chapter 41. Genesis chapter 41. Genesis chapter 41, and we'll look at verses 37 and forward. Remember what Theodore Roosevelt said? Who in the end knows the triumph of high achievement? I believe Joseph had to be a slave first, a prisoner first, so that in the end he would have the character for the high achievement that God elevated him to in the land of Egypt for the express purpose of saving the very brothers that had sold him there. Notice in verse 37, "So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, 'Can we find such a one as this, a man in whom the Spirit of God dwells?'" You see, this is what Joseph had. He had the same thing that we have, the Spirit of Almighty God. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you." This is a guy that just got hauled out of prison. You think about it. Think about it. I challenge you. Think about the number of people down through history that were put in prison because the truth that they spoke was not politically correct and was found to be problematic. Truth is always threatening to powers that be. And they were put in prison to silence them, which which gave them time to write their memoirs, which in some cases have survived for thousands of years. Paul wrote from prison. Joseph was in prison. And I can make you, Nelson Mandela was in prison. I could give you a number of other contemporaries. You know, you put them in prison to shut them up, and precisely the opposite happens. That's how, as long as it's true, it liberates. Prison bars cannot lock up the truth. But you know what can lock it up? Cold and timid souls who do not have the courage to act on what we've been given. Continuing, and you shall be over, verse 40, my house and all my people shall be ruled according to your word, only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. So ultimately, Joseph had all the resources. I go back to this essay from John Mason. I mean, he said, no improvement is so certain as that which proceeds from the right and timely use of whatever you have. Mike Murdoch said, whatever God has already given to you, will create anything else that he has promised you. Everyone who has arrived had to begin where they were in order to get to where God wanted to lead them. This is a powerful credo. It is the doer's credo. Because without doing, you know, we just stay the way you are, the way we are, the way you are. I mean, you never get anywhere else without doing something. Let me show you something from the words of Paul as we conclude over in 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26. For you see your calling. Not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. And most of us could say, no kidding. But there was a purpose. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty, and the base things of the world and the things which are despised God has chosen, and the things which are not to bring them to nothing, the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. That's you and I, where we came from. I jokingly say I'm just an Amish guy who lost his hat. But we have to act. We have to be true to the doer's credo, to do all we can, not just what we can, to do all we can with what we have, where we are at. Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2, in verse 12, speaks to where we were at. That at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealths of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. You jump forward in chapter 2, in verse 19. Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom you are also, the whole building is joined together, grows into the holy temple of the Lord, in whom you are also being built together for a habitation with God in the Spirit. You know, that's an apt description of the church. A growing church must be a doing church. We have heard the doer's credo. Do all you can with what you have, where you are at, and I have one final scripture that shows the ultimate triumph and our role in it if we become doers. 1 Peter chapter 2. Verse 9. But you are, present tense, a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy people, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. My question is, do you do that? Do we do that collectively? That is, I mean, if we are a chosen generation, we are that in order to do something. Who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers. You see, when Paul said that we can do all things through Jesus Christ who strengthens me, he did that in the context of being abased and abound. And if we do not do enough to convict and to create some controversy, chances are we're not doing anything. We're not doing enough. Notice it says that when we have honorable conduct, people will speak against us as evildoers. It's precisely the opposite from what you expect. I mean, that's frankly been my experience. Some of the things that I've done that let's just put it this way. My experience has been that no good deed goes unpunished. So now I just expect it. You know, do a good deed, expect to get beat up. And that's fine. I mean, that's, you know, Paul got beat up for doing the right thing. That's what we should expect. Often decisions that are the right thing to do are difficult decisions that are not popular. But it's still the right thing to do. And this is borne out by this conduct. Having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. That's where we will be. That's where we're going. Or should I say, that's where the doers are going. And the good news is, everybody, you and I, all of us can do all we can with what we have where we are at. That's the doer's credo and a critic's curse.